Welcome all. It's great to have you with us today. As you well know, this year is the sesquicentennial, or 150th anniversary of the formation of Palmerston North. And we undertook to put on, as part of our military history program, a number of presentations. So this particular presentation is going to look at more detail about the military units that occurred or that were formed in Palmerston North from around about the late 1860s towards the end of the land wars leading right up to World War I. Now, the person who's going to talk to us today is no stranger to our presentations, Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Peter Wood, who's the director of the New Zealand Land Wars Study Centre at the New Zealand Defence College, has presented to us a number of times before, and it's great to welcome Peter back today. So without further ado, please welcome Peter Wood.
Kia ora everyone, thanks for the introduction, Joe. It's great to be here, and thank you all for coming along. What I wanted to discuss this afternoon is an important part, really, of the Manawatu's military heritage. It doesn't involve any fighting. It's that period between the end of the wars, as Joe suggested, and the start of the First World War, but it's significant in that it set the foundation for the kind of training and the organisations that would go to the war. Many of the men, of course, left from here. But also today, the units that are based out at Linton in the main, they were often formed as a result of these militias and volunteers. A little bit of a warning, I'm not going to cover uniforms, I'm not going to cover weapons, ranges or tactics. This is more about the people that were in, that made up the different units, and I'm going to primarily tell the story through photographs and back that up with a couple of bits and pieces from the National Archives and from papers past. I'd like to start by acknowledging your Leanne Hickman, who put together an excellent report in 2017 on the military heritage of Palmerston North, and it's an excellent resource to use, but also the Manawatu heritage. They have an enormous number of photographs, including the one that you can see there, that are easily findable through the internet and downloadable, of course. This photo, I like this particular photo. Hopefully you can still hear me out there. This is the Manawatu Mounted Rifles. They're entering the square off Coleman Place. So basically just down in front of where we're seated now. They are riding down there into the square, such as it was in the early 1900s. So, you know, to me, it was sort of evocative of the period, and that some of the places and the descendants of the people involved in that particular ride through into the square would still be amongst us now. I have one wiring diagram, so here it goes. I don't want to scare you with this, but the naming and the dates of all the volunteer and militia units are quite confusing. There were hundreds of units, the Partia Volunteer Rifles, the Wellington Submarine so-and-sos, lots and lots. But so what I've tried to do is simplify it if I can. So essentially the blue represents the infantry organisations as they transition from 1868 through to the beginning of the First World War. And the black represents the cavalry or the mounted rifles organisations as they started again in 1868 and got to be the 6th Manawatu Mounted Rifles Regiment prior to the First World War. So on the infantry side, you'll see that the militia, and in fact on both sides, ceased after a period of a couple of years. So there was a bit of a gap. And then mounted rifles volunteers and Palmerston North Rifles volunteers unit started, so one mounted, one sort of infantry. A second infantry organisation, the Guards, formed a little bit later. And then what we see down here in these two lines is getting all the disparate, differently organised, differently structured, differently led
militia and volunteer units, and they're trying to group them regionally into loose battalion and regimental type structures. So the Guards and the Rifles become a company or companies of the Wellington West Coast Rifle Volunteers, and they have a further reorganisation into the 7th Wellington Battalion. And on the mounted side of the house, the Mounted Rifle Volunteers become a squadron of the Wellington Mounted Rifles and eventually become the 6th Manawatu Mounted Rifles. So I'm not going to go through, I'm going to jump from organisation, but that's just to show you that there is a thing there. And finally, in the red boxes, just showing a period here of the Boer War. We didn't send any fixed units from the region, or neither did anyone else. They contributed manpower and little groups to go away with the different contingents to the Boer War. And our contributions here, the units stayed behind, but instead they created the Wellington Regiment and the Wellington Mounted Regiments and sent them away. And our people from here provided contributions to those organisations. So that's sort of loosely following the genesis of disparate militia organisations and then volunteers through to slightly organised regiments, better organised and trained regiments, and then contributions to the First World War. But many of the militias that formed in New Zealand did so whilst the New Zealand Wars were still running. In fact, as early as 1845, or possibly even before that, unofficially they'd started. But just this picture here shows Papua'ia, our Palmerston North, as it was back then. It was just a clearing inside a large area of bush, and so put the roads over it now, Broadway, Church Street, Victoria Avenue, Fitzherbert. But essentially, that's the size of the clearing, and it was bush all the way down to the Manawatu River. So really in the period that the Manawatu-based militias and volunteers were formed, the New Zealand Wars were essentially over. But this man, George Nelson, was to become a mayor. He's really the starter of our formed forces. But he does make the point, and I put it up there now because it is important. There may have been some minor issues, but essentially, unlike other parts of New Zealand, the relationship between the Pākehā settlers that were here and the Māori tangata whenua was actually pretty good. And the militia and then later the volunteers were not formed specifically against the threat or because of any threat or arguments with the local Māori. They were formed really for wider causes, and eventually the threat was determined more to be overseas, as it actually turned out to be. So the first of the volunteer units really was initiated by this man, George Nelson. His grave's at the cemetery at Terrace End, pretty hard to find and quite unremarkable for such a gentleman as he was and the things that he did. But there's the letter that he wrote. Sir, we the residents of the above town, whose names are appended herewith, beg to offer our services as the Rifle Volunteer Company. And he notes that no other unit exists for a distance of 30 miles. He appends the names of the 57 men who've signed up and agreed that if a unit is approved, that they would join. And then finally that goes all the way to the governor for approval. So you just can't start up a unit, because if you do start up a unit, you'll want firearms, uniforms and other stuff, the capitation funds coming in. So it's got to be done with approval. But also the government wants to know that your unit will have some sort of organisation and will follow some kind of rules. Although rules are interesting in the volunteer sense, and I'll get to that in a second. Well, here, the rules. So volunteer units were much like those that were raised in the United Kingdom. So if we all decided to be a volunteer group, one of us would be elected to be the captain or in charge, and you'd probably vote in a lieutenant, and the officers' appointments would be confirmed at the annual general meeting held every year. And this is a far cry from the way military units, I see some military faces smiling there. This is a far cry from the way that military organisations are run today, but it was a way of encouraging the more natural leaders, or leaders perhaps with some military experience, to be put in positions of control, and then the other members had to be voted in as well, and that kind of assured that you were getting the right sort of people. There were different classes of membership. Most were enrolled members of the volunteers. Some could have the trappings and be honorary members, and they paid extra money, and that was part of it, and they were like patrons for you. And then finally you could go on the reserve. So you might do your service and then basically take your uniform off, but potentially you could go back or be called back if the need ever arose. So, and it also just allowed some of them to retain a link with their old unit. And in fact, that's what we do today. When you retire, you can and often do kind of retain some relationship with your former colleagues. The officer commanding sets the dates and days for parades, usually on a particular night of the week, certain weekends, and the date for an annual camp. Yearly subs for everyone, they had to pay in their 10 shillings, and if they transgressed, talking in the ranks, being absent from parade, there were minor fines that you could be awarded by the officer commanding. Then they would go into the funds and they would end up as prizes at the shooting competition. But actually, it wasn't too onerous. They found that if they fined people too much, it wasn't such a good thing. You could be expelled if you missed a few parades. I don't think that was often done. From the records that I've seen, most people left when they actually left the region or were transferred around rather than for disciplinary reasons. So it was quite an interesting sort of organisation with its own rules. But these rules were replicated around New Zealand by all the volunteer units. There was a proposal by the Scandinavians a few years later to raise their own company. Haven't seen anything, saw no correspondence come back, and nor have I seen a particular a Scandinavian unit raised, but it just shows the idea of forming a volunteer unit was attractive to a lot of the people that were located here. So there's a group of them in 1902 at the showgrounds. They're flanked by bands, but essentially we've ended up with those three units that I explained. We've got the Manawatu Mounted Rifles, and then the two infantry units, the Palmerston North Rifles and the Palmerston North Guards. And there they are again outside All Saints Church. The front rank is the Mounted Rifles under a Captain Peach, who's a doctor, I believe. The second rank is a cadet corps, which is formed by then. So you've got a school, you've got younger males formed up in cadet corps, and then you've got a couple of ranks consisting of the Palmerston North Rifles and Guards. And this particular picture is interesting. This was presented to Captain Mouncey, who was the in charge of the Palmerston North Rifles. This was presented in 1912. And so the difference there is they've essentially gone from a kind of a mass into almost a company kind of structure. And not worried too much about the uniforms, but you know, he's the company commander, you've now got some platoon commanders, you've got a number of platoon sergeants, so you're starting to see more of a structure and more of an emphasis on proper military training and musketry. So you're not professional soldiers, you're not full-time, but you are starting to acquire the look and the skills of soldiers to a degree. Volunteers became an established part of New Zealand society, and they were often referred to as our volunteers, so with some affection. They could be seen going about the town in uniform, generally well regarded in their communities, although occasionally, as is today, there's the odd infraction, but not necessarily representative of everybody. And they didn't just think about the role of defending New Zealand, but the volunteers were a disciplined force and could provide manpower for a range of other tasks. Volunteering was popular across New Zealand. In 1886, about 5% of males were part of the volunteers, and by 1906, it was high as 8%. So that's a lot of people who are interested in being a volunteer. So why did they join? I mean, there's always that defend the country and all that, all those sort of ones, you know. But it was, there were a number of social and recreational considerations. It was, you know, the wearing of uniforms, balls, events. We'll cover some of them. Some just had an interest in soldiering. The uniform maybe attracted some. Being prominent at regional events might have been another one. But essentially, as one volunteer wrote, a volunteer was a modest, law-abiding citizen. And there you are. So perhaps he was biased. These are the Manawatu Mounted Rifles. This is just a group from the, reading off the next slide, this is just another group of the guards back at a Whanganui racecourse where they've gone to a tournament. So often people from Foxham would come here or ours would go to Whanganui, but you tended to do things on a regional basis, but sometimes, as in a couple of cases, they came from all over New Zealand to Palmerston North. Here's this picture of the Mounted Rifles, looking very Boer War in their dress and the way they paraded themselves for that posed photograph. So what I did is I managed to find the nominal roles of this unit over a decade. And so between 1891 as a start point and 1902, there was 61 and then 62 men. So there was about 60 people in the unit throughout the period. Being a mounted unit, initially 25 of the 60 were farmers, and by 1902, 35 of the 60 were farmers. So a lot of them obviously they had horses, were interested in that, and you obviously needed a horse to be that. They were in it. So, but other professionals, and so the volunteers organisation often attracted kind of more professional class. So in amongst the lot, there was an architect, a barrister, a law student, a merchant, three teachers, and a publican. So, you know, that's the kind of, you probably wanted the publican for after the training, but anyway. The youngest in the group, in the first group, was 15 and then 16, so these are quite young there. The oldest was the officer in charge, Lieutenant Dunk, was 40 at the start and then 51 at the end of the period, so he stayed on for a good period. The largest group was sort of in the 21 to 25 year olds in both times, an average age of about 26. But by 1902, there were only six of the originals. Captain Dunk, one of his officers, or two of his officers, Lieutenants Pringle and Munro, a Sergeant Major Lloyd, who'd been a private at the start, Sergeant Batchelor, and Corporal Hoskins, both privates. So a number of the at the start of the period, so a number of those people rose up into the ranks, but quite a few of the junior ranks sort of passed through the unit. I don't know how many in total served in the MMR, but I do know that during the Boer War, 13 of the 60 served in the Boer War, so that's about 21%. And not as the MMR, they went to various contingents along the way. Captain Dunk, a little bit of history there. He was a JP, chairman of the Sluggish River Drainage Board, born in the UK, brought up in a country life on his father's farm working on that, and then he came to the Manawatu, very short stint in Australia, wise man. He bought 1,500 acres on the Foxton line in the Bonessi area now. Farmed 3 sheep per acre besides cattle and horses. Active in public and social affairs. Great interest as captain of the MMR, which he organised in 1891, and as a committee member of the local agricultural and pastoral association. He's a mason, he's married, he's got a son and a daughter. The point about all of this is that things like a lot of the people, they didn't have a military background, and that was good, but it was also a bit of a limitation because it meant, certainly in the early period, they didn't know much of military tactics or procedures, and therefore they relied on those that perhaps did. So there were sometimes some issues there. But this would be overcome in the sort of the 1900s as we started to get into more training and the creation of a permanent force which would pass on information. Air's captain and mayor, Charles Duck. Looking at the detail of some of the people that served in the red box, and I apologise you're not there, but this is Major William Meldrum. Okay, so he's a volunteer, but we know he goes on to be CO of the Wellington Mounted Rifles and then becomes General Officer Commanding of the Mounted Rifles Brigade, and is a very well-known and high-performing officer. In the green box, Mr. Jickle, the engineer, Jickle Street, he's a captain. But what's interesting is about the units that he served in. So I meant before, you know, some hadn't. Well, he'd done 11 years as a volunteer in the UK, Victoria Rifles in Auckland, Auckland Engineers, that's for you, Joe, Nelson City Rifles, and then the Manawatu Mounted Rifles. So they brought all that kind of experience and that profession. Down here, this officer, Levin, is killed in action in the First World War, and Brandon, he's been to South Africa. He's served in South Africa. And some of those brought their experience back to the benefit of the units. The junior officers, well, they're of an age that they were going to go to the First World War. And the purple ones, those four, were killed in action. A couple of other officers have served in South Africa, in fact, three of the others. So that's just a range of the sort of experiences that they've been through before and after their service in the volunteers. But what did the volunteers do? So each night or each week there'd be a night parade. In this particular instance, they've had to form up because the officers are going to be tested by another officer to see that they know how to take and teach drill at arms, proper ceremonial drill. So they're trying to at least get the officer corps at a point where it can instruct properly those under their command. This is a training school has opened. And so from quite a few units really, the officers and the senior NCOs and a couple of junior NCOs are now going on a week-long course, so they parade at the rifle range, do some attack practice, field engineering, Joe, use of triangle of error, semaphore, saluting with swords, topography, field sketching. No, so they're starting to, in a formal way, and collect all these people in to teach them military skills, which they are then expected to pass on to the junior ranks within their units and make them more effective. Because they don't want the numbers, they want the numbers to be effective. So not just to be able to put on a uniform and shoot the rifle, there are all these skills that are becoming important for a military force to be effective, particularly if it's to go overseas. The photo there shows, these are the mounted rifles about to actually go on a funeral procession. It's more just to show off the old drill hall that was there. Each of the units kind of had a drill hall. Sometimes they shared them, and that became their little base camp. Each year, though, they would go on an annual camp, and this still happens today with our territorial forces. I mean, the system is not new. Well, it was then, but it's what we do today with our reserves. So here they are. All our three units have collected together, along with the a field and mounted rifles unit, and they are in those tents living out in the field somewhere just nearby. And can't see it on this screen quite so well, but there's a horse mine for the mounted rifles. So they would just camp nearby, sometimes close to Palmerston North. Mess tent, you know, dining all centralised, some fresh rations, you'd be on cook duties, there'd be a routine set up. Reveille would be like 5:30 or something in the morning. If you're in the mounted rifles, you'd go and tend to the horses, and again, that was a drill that was drummed into them, and they use that in the Sinai Palestine campaign. May have a meal, and then there'd be periods of instruction, a lunchtime, more instruction. After dinner, there would probably be even more instruction, or quite possibly, those officers and NCOs taking the training next day would be revising and thinking about stuff, ready to take it for the next day. But they're not living tactically, right? So they're more like camping. So there is quite a difference there. So today they would be in more like combat conditions rather than tents in their training. But you know, if the camp was nearby, it was a very popular draw card. And there we have Mounted Rifles about to go on to the field near Waldegrave and do some sort of display, getting past the band, and you can just see the sheer numbers of people and the interest that it created in the public to see. Sometimes it's the men that they knew, or just they were interested in the spectacle of the uniforms and the activities that they were portraying there. The range, the Hokafitu range, not shooting, was important. Because, you know, the infantry, of course, but the mounted rifles are basically infantry that ride in on a horse, dismount, and then carry on. So everyone has to know how to shoot, and a range was set up. So clearly that bush has all gone between the clearing and the river by now, and you can clearly see the backdrop that we would recognise. That photo is actually taken in 1915, but it's just to show you the off the target tree. And then when not in use, the range was grazed to keep the grass down. But where was the range? This is the opening of the range. And got that right, yeah. So Mrs. I think Hine is her name. She's the wife of one of the sergeants. They've set up a rifle on a bit of a tripod-y thing. She's about to pull a cord, which will fire the first shot at the range, and then they'll open the range and have a big shoot. So, you know, it was all done with a little bit of ceremony there. And Mayor Snelson and his wife, they're on the right-hand side looking on. Where was the range? I knew there had been a range, but I never quite knew where it was in relation to the lagoon. So ironically, it's now firing over the top of where I work out of, on the defence building in Hokafitu. But besides that, so it had all the way back to an 800 metre mound. So it wasn't just short range stuff. There was quite a lot of marksmanship being applied over that kind of range. So therefore, they had to learn about, you know, aiming off for wind and all that sort of stuff. It appears to be mainly static targets, but nevertheless, they were going for a good distance. And I think a lot of that eventually came through. This is Boer War experience, you know, keep the horses and the mounted rifles going, but you've got to be able to shoot accurately at long range in a volley or even individually. Although it wasn't always safe, and there is a letter there on file, Captain Dunk was shot between the fleshy part of both thighs. So essentially when you're shooting, and this still happens today, if you are one of the soldiers, at the target end, you are below ground or behind pretty solid protection. That's the butts, as we call it. And then they shoot down there, and you are kind of below thing, and pew, 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 stuff's going over the top. Well, Captain Dunk apparently was somewhere just off to the side where there was not quite so much cover. Anyway, he got shot. The letter of explanation made it all the way up to the Minister of Defence. I don't think there was any punishment meted out. He kind of had that. But, yeah, so accidents do happen. Military tournaments were a huge feature. The top picture there is some engineers in the Palmerston North showgrounds. They have built a bridge. And down here you've got, at a King's tournament, you've got a number of soldiers showing off their drill, kind of an on-guard position, all that kind of thing. And, of course, it gets a lot of accolades, and there's a lot of public interest. 10,000 people came to that tournament here. Now, I do have care of Chris Pugsley. He sent up this program for the 1910-1911 Naval and Military Tournament and Assault at Arms to be held at the A&P Showgrounds in Palmerston North. And it's got some pretty incredible sort of stuff that they did in there. There was a route march, pack marching from the square down Fitzherbert Street. You had to cross the Manawatu River on foot. There was some tasks to be done on the other side, and then you had to come all the way back up. But that was your unit team, so you were competing. Not only Palmerston North Guards and Rifles and Manawatu, but you had other units here that you were competing against. There was field observation, trying to look out and spot things that they'd hidden away in the field. There were sword versus sword fights whilst mounted with points awarded between the Dominion Scouts, the Manawatu Mounted Rifles and the South Canterbury Mounted Rifles, so they came from afar. There was a cockade fight or balaclava melee where they basically, it was a big stoush that they had with sticks and fighting on horseback. That would have been a good wrestling on horseback. We'll skip past lemon cutting. There was a costume race where you rushed off on your horse, dismounted, picked up a cigarette, got on your horse, jumped the jump, found the lighter, got back on horse, jumped the jump, lit the cigarette, then jumped the jump and got to the finish line with the cigarette going. I mean, we wouldn't necessarily do that today, but these are the kind of things that they would do. And there was an infantry Maxim gun competition, so setting up the machine gun. And whilst they, of great interest, what it does is it causes the soldiers to actually be able to do things quickly and under pressure of competition. And this is a skill that they'll need to be able to do whilst under fire. Tent pegging. Oh, God. So there's quite a lot of stuff that they do, quite apart from physical drill, bayonet fighting, and tent pitching and striking. So all those things are good, but probably the activity that everyone enjoys the most is the mock battle. And so they'll actually have an enemy group, and the mounted guys will come in, and then the infantry will fight. There'll be lots of blanks fired and all that sort of thing. Really used to delight the crowd. And this wasn't just a Palmerston thing. This kind of thing would be happening all across New Zealand. And so as well as building up the training standards of the troops, it's showing the others of New Zealand just the sort of skills that they are learning and providing a little bit of entertainment. So where did some of this training lead? Well, there was certainly Boer War service. There's a couple of brothers, or probably brothers there from Palmerston North. Quite a number of New Zealanders served in the Boer War. If I just go back to my bits of paper there, got the numbers. About 6,000 New Zealanders served in the Boer War. Some 58 were killed. 136 though died of disease, so illness and some of these theatres, and there's 190 wounded in action. Many came from the Manawatu. I'm not sure of the exact number, but I do know, and over there at our cenotaph, there's a lot of World War One names, but there's only one name, Anderson W, Private William Anderson. He was a member of the 3rd contingent, the Rough Riders. He wasn't killed, he died of enteric fever, and quite a lot of soldiers did. And it's things like that, about illness and having hospitals, about teaching soldiers proper skills and drills, having organisations for logistics and supply. This is why when they come back, New Zealand also introduces and starts to create those other units that are more than just the combat forces that everyone would like to be part of. You actually need a much broader array of units to have a proper military force that's going to survive. There's no point just sending a whole lot of horsemen over there if they all starve, or they can't be taken or treated if they've been wounded. So what we see after the Boer War, and there have been a number of reviews over the years, is this determination to create a territorial force. So no longer will it just be the purview of interested people to volunteer. By 1909, they want to territorially, by area, create a substantial military force. 30,000 is a lot, is big, and most of it's going to be done by compulsory military training. And they're going to take that scattered mass of hodgepodge units of different structures and standards and smash them into better organised, standardised units that can be trained across New Zealand and will be more than just the infantry and the rifles and the artillery and engineer units that, fair enough, are starting to be created. But you need logisticians, you need medics, you're going to need vets, you need transport, so all that sort of thing. Officers, and they're going to be drawn from the ranks, so they're going to have some New Zealand experience with troops. There's going to be compulsory training, and the numbers, 25,000 people are in it, the scheme, by 1914. So there's quite a lot of soldiers or people who've had military experience by the time they join in World War One. Now, the territorial units, though, can't themselves be mobilised for overseas service. And it was the same in the Second World War. Essentially, they created a new structure, and so we, from the Manawatū, we were required to provide a company to the Wellington Regiment as infantry, company or squadron to the Wellington Mounted Regiment as the Mounted Rifles, and other detachments of engineers, artillery, logistics to sort of make the units that are going overseas. So we've ended up in a kind of a territorial arrangement. That's the map, I apologise there, but my camera's side. So everywhere north of Taupo is kind of the Auckland district. Between Taupo and Wellington is Wellington district. The Canterbury district is two-thirds of the South Island, and the Otago's are kind of down there. And then when you look in to where Palmerston North is, we are Era 6. We've got an area headquarters, but we are servicing an infantry battalion, a mounted rifles regiment, and we're providing artillery, engineers, and other logistics elements all out of our area, which includes Fielding, Martin, Hunterville, Taihape, Whanganui, and Palmerston North. So you've gone from this kind of like shotgun, they're all over the place, to a very organised and structured thing, and that serves us very well for mobilisation into the First World War, because a lot of people also joined who didn't have the experience of being in the territorials, and in fact it's pretty much the same structure and organisation that we have going into the Second World War as well. So it's pretty well thought out. Contribution to the First World War, well, I've kind of explained it really. In the large chunks were squadrons to the Mounted Rifles Regiment, the Wellington Mounted Rifles. You know, they serve in Gallipoli and then the Sinai-Palestine campaign. And then companies to the Wellington Regiment that again serve in Gallipoli but then go off to the Western Front. And then contributions to all the other artillery, engineers, logistics and other units there come from the region. So this territorial system has provided the basis for our presence or our structured and organised presence in both the First World War and ultimately up to the Second World War. There's about 84 names on the Palmerston North War Memorial in the square there. I'm not quite sure how many of them had volunteer service, but I would say probably on the figures I've seen, or estimate at least half. So that really concludes the presentation, the look at the units that we've got. I'm happy to take any questions or comments. This New Zealand journey, though, is not unusual. Australian militias were formed in other countries, and indeed New Zealand peacekeepers and New Zealand contingents, when they deploy nowadays, often, for example, into Timor, you're taking former organisations that fought as, say, guerrilla organisations, and you're trying to transition them into a defence force. So this was our particular journey, and largely the part played by the Manawatū area in that journey. So now happy to take questions or comments.
Thank you, Peter. I've got one question. You mentioned the 57 individuals that started off in the very early piece under Bruce Nelson. Where did they come from? What sort of individuals were they?
They are the original, and they are pretty much, I think it's almost all the males that are here at the time, or many of them that are here at the time. So they are different from the volunteers where they're going to be, say better, but of a more professional bent. These will be everything from flax millers, saw millers, shopkeepers, farmers, kind of whole works. I don't have their exact makeup, but militia tend to be represent a better cross-section of everybody in your area, whereas the volunteers, there's also a delightful little piece in here where the militia ask, can we have a volunteer unit because it's less onerous. So the militia were kind of, you know, had to get out there and do guard duty, and there were lots of parades and restrictions, and it was compulsory for people over the age of 18. So if you could be a volunteer and elected into that in a slightly higher group, that's where you get your more specialists. So I don't have the exact answer, I never looked into their detail, but they were a wide range of people.
A lot of the British infantry and some engineers and other elements after the land wars decided not to go back to England and demobilised in New Zealand. So we had a lot of those who came out from England as part of the British forces to protect the colonials. And they actually remained in New Zealand, took their uniform off, and then they became the nucleus of a lot of these militia units as well, and contributed to a lot of our early military history. But if you go around Palmerston North, some of the Poppy Places streets, you'll see the names. There's Duck Place over by the airport, there's Snelson Street up the road here. So a lot of those individuals, apart from their being mayors of Palmerston North, are also closely associated with that early military structure. Other questions?
So it sounds like it grew from the ground up rather than the top down. How was the relationship?
It grew from the bottom up in the militia and the volunteers area, and so certainly for volunteers, you ask for your unit to be created, and then you draw, and you are given a rough number of people that you can have in there, say 50 to 60, but there was no particular structure. But the other organisation that we ended up with in 1911, 12, 13, that was very much a top-down view of an idea. We needed a divisional structure, so we needed this number of regiments and brigades. These three infantry regiments, they need a regiment of artillery, a regiment of engineers, they need a supply regiment and a field hospital. So that bit was very much a top-down driven bit. And so you end up with a messy period. But in the 1902-3 period, as they heading towards that, and then trying to shoehorn that into the territorials, and then they basically use conscription to fill it in. Yeah, but hence, I mean, at the militia end of the scale, just the naming of all the organisations and the uniforms and what they got up to was across New Zealand. It was a very much a bottom-up driven thing, and often key individuals were responsible for initiating the creation of an organisation and then what it got up to.
Was there a professional standing army at the time, or was
not at the start? So yeah, in fact, here's a point I should have covered, but they mainly never came from the Manawatu. So the British regiments were leaving by the late 60s and mostly going. Some of them did stay behind. So you had a period where the volunteers were out there, but there wasn't really anybody kind of supervising them too much. So at the same time, they create a staff corps of officers, and some of them get sent to Duntroon and off overseas to learn their craft. And then you've got a permanent corps of mainly NCOs who their job is to go and instruct and teach in schools of musketry and the other things there. So you do end up with a permanent force, or permanent regulars becoming created. And by 1912 or 13, prior to the war, each of those territorial units, maybe the adjutant, some of the warrant officers, some of the senior NCOs, they will be regulars. But the rest of the unit will be made up of their territorials. And indeed, that's a model that we follow today. So obviously, adjutant is a regular officer of the Auckland Battalion, but the company commanders were all territorials. My CO was a territorial. The RSM was a regular. And each of the companies of up to 100 soldiers had a territorial company commander, but they usually had a sergeant or a staff sergeant Carter NCO who helped recruit them, organise the training, and supported the officers who were then supposed to train their company. So yeah, we also see the creation of a more professional group to administer, but also to help train the territorials in particular.
So you're trying to create something to rapidly scale?
Well, yes, that's right, because in fact the World War I deployment was way bigger than I think was initially envisaged on mobilisation. Yeah, but you need to have the cadre, and I think one of the issues in the start-up of World War II, they had the territorials here, but by that point, the professional group had got so small that the territorials were basically left to start to train themselves, and they fell back on their World War I, some of their older World War I people to do that.
But the territorial organisation was fairly well established after the Boer War, but then we had a key milestone in 1910. We had Kitchener came out to New Zealand, and he was out here for about 2 or 3 months to advise the New Zealand government on setting up a permanent force. But this was before anybody talked about World War One, you know, coming along. And so the New Zealand government at the time didn't really commit to actually setting up a regular force or a permanent force, other than the fact that, as Peter mentioned, you know, we had the staff corps for officers and we had this small cadre of experienced NCOs and the like. And then, of course, when World War One was declared in 1914, all hell broke loose. So they went into this massive conscription and, you know, reorganisation role. But it's an interesting transition.
Yeah.
Sorry, Cliff, you were wanting to ask a question.
Yeah, I happen to know the current whereabouts of a couple of Lancers that apparently came from the 200 rifles.
Do you know where they are?
Yes.
They're sitting in the museum.
No, they're not. They're sitting in Ashford.
Oh, you've got, you know those ones. All.
Same
but
ones.
We somehow inherited two in the Engineer Museum, which we don't talk too much about, do we, Claire?
The old barracks was pretty close to our house, and Dad saw a whole lot of trucks going in to sort out the stuff in the old barracks. And he was in the Territorial Artillery Unit there, went to inquire, and he said, "What are you doing? We're taking all the stuff to the dump."
Mm.
Yeah. So he went to pick up two Lancers, and they said, "You can't touch them." So he grabbed a Land Rover, followed them to the dump, and picked them up and presented them to the Masonic Lodge of Archaeo Services. That is now defunct. So they have found their home in Otanagi, Ashurst, with the instructions they are to be used every ANZAC service. And if the lodge folds at any time, they are to go back to Linton to the cavalry unit.
Yeah. QMR would gladly.
Would you also like to have a look at your original insignia for the Mounted Rifles?
Yep.
Yeah.
Bring it on. Get in front of the camera so we can
see it.
Paul Revere from Revere Embroideries here in Palmerston North, of course, has got quite a lot of military history items that the firm has obviously done a lot of work over many, many years. It's amazing what Paul keeps coming up with these days.
I walked up and got soaked.
Oh, this is where you had it coming, Paul.
My question was, is there any evidence of when they used these lances? As in the days of jousting and... Apparently they
did have jousting competitions, yes, British style jousting competitions. Not sure how they
the safety. The little badge, I understand, was the original. Now this larger one was a pennant, and it's drawn by my grandfather in 1919. Wow. Now, exactly what they used the pennant, I have
On their lances.
On the lances.
Only guessing.
Lances.
Yes.
Yeah.
So those are the original. That's the original unit badge that was done. I'm not sure that it's not dated, which is unusual because right through the history of all hand embroidery in our place anyway, whoever drew the design actually signed it and dated it. So that one's 1919.
Yeah.
Right, that's excellent.
Brilliant, isn't it?
That's very good.
Now, if you come out to the Engineer Museum, a couple of items, we do have a couple of lances out there, which we don't want to talk too much about because our neighbours are QAMR, Queen Alexander Mounted Rifles, next door, or on the back end of the building, and they no doubt come and purloin them. But the other thing that we've got in our uniform collection is actually a slouch hat from the 6th Manawatu Mounted Rifles from the Boer War. It's got Plumer, General Plumer, who was the British commander in the Boer War. Plumer's New Zealand rifles, isn't it? Or Bushman, that's right. It's got Plumer's New Zealand Bushman, And it's also got a bullet hole through the top of the slouch hat, which adds a little bit of authenticity to it.
You had a photograph of the band,
mm-hmm.
one of the...
Yeah.
I've just digitised one of the sashes for the drum major of the Pumps North Volunteers. And that's the original design of the, which is a drawing like this. So, and the oldest design I have found, and I've saved most of the ones apart from the ones we lost in the fire, goes back to 1871. So a lot of the units and Wellington, so on and so forth, there are badges.
Yeah.
That they used
to address you. Yeah. Right. No, thank you very much.
Any other questions? Other questions? Yes.
Regarding the uniform, I noticed in the very early picture of the 1910, the hat they were wearing has got a folded up rim Australian style. They would have a hat or a badge on it. Would you really change to a flat rim hat?
Well, I don't know when we did. Hats, even in the current military era of the last 20 years, they change a lot depending on who's there. And even William Malone, Lieutenant Colonel, CEO of the Wellington Regiment in World War I, changed the slouch hat to make it flat so that the rain would come off, and he changed the peak with the changed the thing into a peak so it represented the mountain but also allowed the rain to run off. So there was a lot of local adaptation. No doubt there would be some regulation or issue thing, but I personally don't know when we went from one lot of headdress to the other. But I do believe someone's going to come and talk about uniforms in detail.
Next month we've got a presentation from Barry O'Sullivan. What date is it? 15th of April. There'll be a presentation by Barry O'Sullivan on New Zealand military uniforms. So that could be a good question to keep for Barry, because he's one of the national experts on military uniforms.
I undertook not to talk about uniforms deliberately, knowing, but the pictures that I've seen of the styles and everything that they did, there's some excellent stuff that's out there. So it would be very interesting talk, and I'm sure he'd be able to answer that more fully for you.
Any other questions you've got? Yeah.
Did they have to finance their own rifle and kits and stuff like that?
The weapons, ammunition, mostly came, and uniforms eventually mostly came from the government, but one of the issues with being a volunteer was the money that you got never really covered everything, and so often they would contribute for their own uniform costs in particular, and quite possibly things like those and the badges and the insignia would fall on the unit to reproduce, but the weapons and the ammunition, when I've seen traffic correspondence, there's been something's happened to a ship that's been sunk and now there's a delay in weapons coming up, or they've said, look, we've got extra soldiers now, can we have more rifles, or we've got these old ones, can we get new ones? So those sort of things are being provided for centrally, and not I didn't include it in Snelson's letter, but in there he guaranteed that he had secure storage for weapons and for ammunition and a range as part of the approval process for setting up the unit. Some may have brought their own weapons and stuff, but...
Yeah, I think...
especially in the militia, really.
Coming up next month as well, on the 10th of April, Saturday, is the opening of the CET Arena, the redevelopment project that's going on at the moment. And a lot of this history and some of the material that Peter's covered will actually be presented digitally at the arena, in a number of the different displays, virtual displays that they've got built in. We've fed a lot of that history from Manawatu Heritage and from a number of other organisations around Palmerston North into those digital displays. So the one he showed of the Wellington Engineer Volunteers doing a military tournament at the showgrounds back in November 1908, I know that one's certainly in there. And in fact, we've actually got the trophy, the Scots Cup, out at the museum in Linton which was used as the trophy for that particular those particular tournaments, normally on the King's birthday or Boxing Day, with the two dates in each year that they used to hold these military tournaments, particularly at the showgrounds. And it was a very, very popular event. And, you know, as you said, if there was an open day for an annual camp or any of those military tournaments, you'd get just as about as many of the, well, what was the population then?
Yeah,
well, because, yeah. You know, huge numbers of people that turn up. Them
training up from Wellington, coming from all over the place just to have a look.
Yeah. Any other questions? All right, well, look, once again, can you please put your hands together and thank Peter.